First, I want to thank the organizers for putting this session together. It's been fascinating so far, and it's always nice to be able to sit in a room and see all the different perspectives on mineral weathering across a variety of different scales. So to start, I should start off by saying that I was privileged to be Bob Berner's last graduate student, so I've been thoroughly indoctrinated into the long-term carbon cycle and the role of biological systems, in particular trees. So this is how I started my PhD, was looking at long-term carbon system, how plants in particular and the evolution of plants can contribute to the long-term carbon system. So this is looking at CO2 coming from the atmosphere being dissolved into rain or taken out by trees. This then can be put into the ground and come in contact with minerals as either bicarbonate or as organic molecules. In particular, we're looking at calcium and magnesium because these then can be washed downriver into the ocean and can precipitate as calcium magnesium carbonates at the bottom of the ocean floor. These are then eventually subducted and eventually, again, over tens of millions of years, can be degassed by volcanoes back into the atmosphere. So this is a cycle that takes place on that time scale of tens of millions of years, but it's the same processes that affect soil formation on much shorter timescales. So I got very, very interested in sort of two ways of looking at this. One, the biological evolution on the surface of the Earth is deeply connected to the geochemical evolution of the surface of the Earth. And I got very fascinated by the fact that something like trees could actually have an impact on CO2 in the atmosphere on these very long timescales. So if you want to think about it, trees can actually accelerate the mineral weathering by taking up CO2. They want to get nutrients from the minerals, and so there is a biogeochemical cycling going on, either through carbonate exudation through the roots or through organic molecules, that can then interact with the minerals in the soil or minerals in the bedrock to form soil. And this accelerates the entire process. So if we're looking at geological timescales, so again, this long-term carbon cycle is really active on the tens of millions or longer timescale. So on a geological perspective, land plants first arose in the Devonian, but we had angiosperms evolving much later in the Cretaceous. So one of the questions I had was, do different evolutionary groups of plants have a different interaction with the geochemical surface? And have they actually affected the long-term carbon cycle during the geological history differently? Now, one thing to keep in mind, it's not just that land plants evolved by themselves. They also evolved with arbuscular mycorrhizae. This is one of the ways that plants were actually able to transition to land. And around the same time, angiosperms and some of the more recent gymnosperms evolved in the Cretaceous, we also had ectomycorrhizal fungi. So this is something to keep in mind as I go through the talk. We'll come back to the fungi at a later point. So this is a big, complex system, and obviously I can't run an experiment on geological timescales. So my goal is to try and understand weathering processes at a variety of scales in modern day, starting with the field, because I want to see, can we see in the field differences in mineral weathering, differences in soil chemistry under different plants, under different biological systems. And then taking either mesocosm, microcosm, using some microscopy, work our way down to what are the molecules and processes that these biological entities are actually using to get nutrients from these rocks and affect the long-term carbon cycle. Ideally, I would like to then, once we understand some of these processes better, develop techniques and tools to be able to go back to the field level and actually study these processes in situ in the very complex soil environment. And if all that actually works, we can use what we understand there to look back in deep time and understand how biological evolution has affected geochemical evolution over the geologic history of the Earth. And it will also give us insight into how these processes can then be changing as we go forward under different global climate change, or even just time going forward under different land use change and under potential different plant evolution. So this is sort of the format this talk is going to take. We're going to start with the field and work our way down slower, and hopefully I'll show you that there is a way to get from the molecules and processes back to the field. So to start with, I have a field site in the Cascade Mountains in Washington. This is an area I chose because it gets a decent amount of rain. It has very young soils. The deepest soils are about 35 centimeters. Average soil depth is more like 23, 24 centimeters. It is one of the big questions when you're looking in the field is how do you know that what you see in the soil is due to the plants that are there today, or are the plants that are there today due to some previous differences in the soil? So my reasoning for picking this particular field site is that this area has been dominantly Douglas fir and western red cedar, dominantly Douglas fir, for thousands of years, to the best of our knowledge. And so anywhere that I see an angiosperm, in this case it's bigleaf maple and red alder that dominate areas of disturbance where they have grown, I'm assuming that the underlying soil is predominantly due to the Douglas fir forests that have been there for millennia. And any differences I may see in the soil under these new trees, new being very relative, new being a few hundred years old, are due to the trees that are there now. So for this particular site, the parental base unit is a granite diorite. The two images there are standing right in the middle of my transect, facing in two opposite directions. So it really is a very clean line in the middle of this transect. And it's all angiosperms, again, bigleaf maple and red alder. And on the conifer side, it is dominantly Douglas fir and western red cedar. In the cartoon below it, I've indicated the position of the trees along my transect, and the black dots are indicators of where I took soil cores. So one of the hypotheses that we had going in, there are sort of two opposite hypotheses. One is that angiosperms, which have evolved later, they're more complex, they have flowers, they're more energy intensive, and maybe they need more nutrients because they are creating these flowers. Many of them are deciduous and shedding leaves every year. So there's reason to think that they might actually accelerate mineral weathering because they simply need more nutrients every year. On the other side of that, they also evolved later when soils were much more established on the surface of the earth. And so there's reason to think that maybe they wouldn't be as efficient as weathering because they don't have to get the nutrients from rocks. They have a lot more access to soil and deeper soil. So trying to figure out which of those two hypotheses might be correct was one of the first goals of my PhD. And one of the first ways I wanted to do this was by taking these soil cores from this transect and simply looking at the bulk chemistry underneath. So these are representative cores from the two sides of the transect. There are differences in the soil. There tends to be more clay under the angiosperms, and there's no clay visible at all under the gymnosperms. When I looked at the bulk soil chemistry, I grouped samples into three depths, so 4 to 8 centimeters deep, 10 to 16, and 17 to 23. And that's what you see here. On the left side are the angiosperms, and on the right side is the gymnosperms, and this will be the same for these three plots. For this one, again, because the long-term carbon cycle is primarily run by calcium and magnesium, we're going to focus on calcium and magnesium, but I'll also be talking about iron a little bit. When you look at the calcium, well, there's some subtle variations in what you see in terms of calcium leaching from the soil with different depths. You really see very similar calcium leaching under both sides of trees. So I don't see any difference in calcium. If you're just looking at calcium, you would say there is exactly the same role of both of these sets of trees on the long-term carbon cycle. Or you could also say that the angiosperms that are there have not had a chance to change the soil at all. And what you see in the soil is still due to that original Douglas fir forest. However, when you look at magnesium, you see a very different story. You actually see accumulation on the angiosperm side, particularly at surface layers, which indicates that there may be a litter recycling component to this. And you still see leaching from the gymnosperm side, and you don't see accumulation in the same way. So there is definitely a different imprint on these soils from the angiosperms on that side of the transect. And if you look at iron, you see something very similar. There is still iron leached from beneath the angiosperms, but it's much less being leached than what you see under the gymnosperms. So this could indicate that there is simply more acidity under the gymnosperms, or that there is something more biological going on with either a siderophore, some sort of chelating molecule, or, as I said, litter recycling. So from the same soil core, some of them were sacrificed and used for this bulk soil analysis. Some of them were very carefully epoxied to preserve mineral emplacement in the soil core. And this is an example of looking at some of the minerals. These are our backscatter electron images underneath the angiosperm side and the gymnosperm side, looking at hornblende, biotite, and plagiate clays. These are the dominant calcium and magnesium bearing minerals in these soils. And as you can see, for all three minerals, there is significantly more physical and chemical weathering beneath the gymnosperms. So this does align well with what we see in the bulk soil. In particular, if you look at the plagioclase on the bottom, the sort of outer rim of the original plagioclase mineral is still visible and it's been weathered away. And those fragments are still calcic plagioclase. They have not been turned into clay. And in particular, if you get lucky when you look at these thin sections and you find roots, and those original mineral root positions have been preserved in the epoxy. And these are representative, but this is indicative of what I saw throughout the soil cores, was that minerals that were in contact with angiosperm roots were less weathered than minerals that were in contact with the gymnosperm roots. These are both calcium plagioclase, and you can see there is significant weathering on both. But this indicates it's always the face that's facing the root that has the more significant weathering. So this suggests that there really is something to do directly with the root affecting mineral weathering. And I wanted to dig a little bit deeper to see why, because it's a little bit difficult to find these processes in the field. So I did some complementary laboratory experiments, and I grew trees in the lab for about a year. And I put similar minerals, both granite and basalt. So here we're going to look at calcium plagioclase, because that was what was easiest to retrieve from all the different levels. I put them in these little plexiglass tubes that I had drilled holes in so roots and fungi and bacteria could still get in, but I could retrieve the minerals for analysis easily at the end of the experiment. And I looked at pH, and I looked at organic acids. And I want to state here, we looked at 14 different organic acids. These are commonly found in forest soils, and we have grouped them into monoclinic carboxylic acids and dicarboxylic acids. And dicarboxylic acids in particular have a stronger chelating ability and would have at least the potential to interact more strongly with these mineral and cations. So first we wanted to do a litter decomposition. So this is looking at the control and then the Douglas fir litter and the maple litter. And relative to the control, the Douglas fir litter considerably acidified our soil at the end of this experiment, whereas the maple litter actually raised the pH. So this indicates that there is a strong source of acidity coming just from the litter decomposition on the gymnosperm side. If you look at the seedling experiments, the angiosperm, both bulk soil and rhizosphere soils, didn't change significantly from the control, but under the gymnosperms, both the bulk soil and the rhizosphere soil are a little bit more acidic. When you look at the organic acids, the scale here is nanomoles of acid per gram soil per gram biomass. So one of the things to note here, the scale, it goes up to 6. This becomes important in the next graph. And if you look at the Douglas fir litter, the dark bars are dicarboxylic acids, and the lighter color bars are monocarboxylic acids. So under the gymnosperm litter, you have roughly equal proportions with the monocarboxylic and the dicarboxylic, although there is a much lower overall total of acids present in the system. If you look at the maple litter, you have significantly more organic acids going into the system, but they're almost all monocarboxylic. When you look at the rotated graph, which shows the bulk and rhizosphere soils from the tree seedling experiments, again, the striped is the monocarboxylic acids, the solid bars are the dicarboxylics, and then the sort of squiggly lined ones are the total. If you look at the top two, they are the birch and the maple rhizosphere. And then the deciduous bulk, they have lower concentrations of the dicarboxylic acids. They also have a little bit lower overall concentrations of organic acids going into the system. The conifer rhizosphere is by far the most significant source of dicarboxylic acids and organic acids overall going into this system. So this really suggests that between the litter adding acidity and the organic acids coming from the seedlings. And note here, so the graph for the litter goes up to 6 nanomoles, the graph for the seedlings goes up to 600. So the seedlings really are the dominant source for these organic acids going into the system. But are they causing the same sort of weathering that we're seeing in our field system? And so for that, I took these minerals back out of our system and did some backscatter electron imaging. What I looked at here are, these are dominantly a potassium plagioclase, but they have calcium plagioclase lamella within the system. And those calcium plagioclase lamella were etched. So the graph you see here are the number of etch pits per surface area of these minerals at the end of a 13-month experiment. To the left, you see the control. It corresponds to the fresh mineral in the upper left corner. So these were not pristine minerals I had to account for. There were a few etch pits just in the original minerals that I put in the system. The soil control, you do see additional etching because there is acidity in the soil. But you see many more etch pits on the Douglas fir litter, and particularly the conifer seedlings. And for these particular experiments, the seedlings did not have a litter layer in them, so I did separate the effects of the litter and the seedlings. But both the litter and the seedlings have more edge pitting than the angiosperm systems. So this correlates very well to what we're seeing in the field and suggests that at least at this level, we are seeing more leaching from beneath the gymnosperms due to both greater acidity and additional dicarboxylic and particular organic acids. We see more magnesium and more iron leaching from the soil beneath the gymnosperms. We see more mineral weathering in the field, more edge pitting in the lab. There are a lot of things that you know could be contributing to this. We do see leaf litter recycling as a potential, at least short-term, way that the angiosperms are keeping certain nutrients, particularly metals, in the system. It's a little bit unclear exactly what this means over longer time scales, over thousands to millions of years, but it does at least give us an idea of how the biology of the two different systems do work very, very differently. As you mentioned at this point, I was treating the trees and their microbial ecosystems as one biological unit. So these were not sterile systems. The laboratory experiments were not sterile experiments. The field is obviously not sterile. So these trees each come with their own set of microbes and fungi. I got very lucky with the four main tree species in the field system for both the angiosperms and the gymnosperms. One was arbuscular mycorrhizal and one was ectomycorrhizal based on the species. So there should have been sort of a balancing effect there, but I don't know for sure. And for these particular experiments, I wasn't able to look at the fungi themselves. But I did want to know, is it really the trees that are having this impact, or is it something about their microbial communities? So at the University of Sheffield, we had some growth chamber mesocosms, and we wanted to look at this exact question. We wanted to see, does it depend on the tree species? Does it depend on the ectomycorrhizal or arbuscular mycorrhizal status of these plants? And so we set up some mesocosms where for these mesh bags, much like the mesh bags that Rebecca was talking about, these are just cylinders, we could put basalt or granite in them at different levels in the mesocosm. And they were separated by an outer mesh in the mesocosm itself that you can see here, and then a mesh-covered mineral cylinder could be slid into those. So that allowed us to sample over time and also with depth. For the tree species, we took a ginkgo, a sequoia, and a magnolia species. These were all done with 20-ish replicates, depending on how many survived. And these were our arbuscular mycorrhizals, so the three on the left. And then the pine and the birch were our more modern angiosperms and pine, and these were ectomycorrhizal. Now at the end of a year-long experiment, these again were not kept sterile, but they were kept as sterile as we could manage. And you can look at the plant-free control. These are the minerals and perlite that we have removed from those mineral cylinders from the mesocosms. In the plant-free control, you don't visually see any fungal hyphae. For the sequoia, you can see the faint hyphae all over the surface of the mineral there. And they also are forming bridges between minerals, much like Rebecca showed. So they really do hold on quite tightly. And then under the pine, you can see ectomycorrhizae, appears to be less biomass than you see under the sequoia. So for this, it's more biomass for the arbuscular mycorrhizae and less biomass for the ectomycorrhizal. And this was true across all of the species we looked at. And we confirmed this using a chitin bioassay to estimate the amount of fungal biomass, so we weren't just relying on this visual indicator, but they did match. There was significantly more biomass under the sequoia and significantly less under the pine. But the way we had this system set up, we could feed the trees radioactive carbon and watch it go through the system in real time and measure how much carbon was actually being allocated from the tree to the mycorrhizal fungi in these mineral systems. So when we want to look at carbon allocation, on the left-hand side of this is the ginkgo, sequoia, and magnolia, again our arbuscular mycorrhizae. The birch and the pine are ectomycorrhizae. And you can see from this that there's significantly more carbon being allocated to the lower biomass ectomycorrhizae in those systems. And so on the right-hand side of that, we've just averaged all of the arbuscular mycorrhizae together and the ectomycorrhizae together, suggesting or treating it as though it really is the fungal component that is dominating the process here, rather than the individual tree species. But what we're interested in is not just carbon allocation. We want to know, how does this relate to mineral weathering? And so we also looked at calcium dissolution. So this is dissolution both from the basalt and from the granite, dominantly from the basalt. And again, it's set up the same way with the ginkgo, the sequoia, and the magnolia to the left, and the pine and the birch to the right. So for the arbuscular mycorrhizal, these experiments were also done, I should mention, at two different CO2s. We were looking at evolutionary effects of modern day CO2 versus geological time average CO2. But regardless of the CO2, you see significantly less calcium dissolution under the arbuscular mycorrhizal trees, and significantly more, particularly under the pine at high CO2. So this suggests that maybe it isn't just the tree species, maybe it is the fungus. And this sort of goes back to what we saw in both in the field and those complementary laboratory experiments, that it was the dicarboxylic acids as well as just acidity being added to the system that was really contributing to the weathering. So if it's those sorts of molecules that are being dominant in terms of the biological effect on mineral weathering, there are other biological molecules that can actually have a more significant effect on mineral weathering, and these are siderophores. So these are small organic molecules. They're generally bigger than the organic acids that we were looking at before. They have a very high affinity for iron and other metals, and they're actually produced by microbes, bacteria, and fungi, as well as some plants, specifically, we think, to go get iron and other minerals, or other metals, from minerals. So one of the issues with getting iron out of soil, even though there's plenty of iron there, it's there in either an iron 3, but particularly as a mineral solid form, which is very difficult for the plants to take up. So, and same for bacteria and fungi. So producing siderophores is a way to actually get that nutrition out of the rock directly without having to dissolve an entire rock. Or they could help dissolve rocks. Also, they may accelerate that. So this is an organic molecule that may have an even stronger effect. So it seems like a logical target to try and study. But there's some challenges with this. First, there's at least 500 structures that are known. They're very, very diverse. They come in a range of different structural backbones and different binding moieties. So they can come in wide varieties of structures and sizes and even metal affinities. So trying to measure each of these can be very time consuming, very expensive, and also require very specialized knowledge and equipment. And in addition to that, they're actually found in the environment in extremely low concentrations. So this is not 10 nanomolars of any particular siderophore, this is 10 nanomolars of siderophore. So this is 10 nanomolars of many different structures, which poses a significant analytic challenge. One thing you can do is, for example, in the ocean, you can take 500 gallons of water and concentrate that down to a very small sample and try and measure that. But that's time consuming and potentially adds bias. And you have similar issues with some of the other environmental scenarios. Now, in the rhizosphere, you can get higher concentrations, but these are still very small areas and can be very problematic in terms of getting enough sample to actually do the measurement. And while we like to say, you know, these plants and fungus and bacteria are producing siderophores to go out and get iron and bring it back to them, that may or may not be what's actually happening with every siderophore. There's a lot of very perilous paths as a siderophore can travel between an organism, a mineral, and back. So there may be degradation, they may interact with other substances, they may get stuck onto other minerals, they may get eaten by other microbes, or their metals may actually be taken up by other organisms. So it's actually a very complicated system, and this means that not only do we need to measure a wide variety of structures in very low concentrations, we need to be able to do it very quickly and on very small scales to really get a good snapshot of the processes that are occurring under a given plant or with a given bacteria and a mineral. So one of the ways around this, rather than trying to actually measure individual siderophores and their activities in soils, is to try and get a quick snapshot of all of the siderophore activity or all of the chelating activity in the soil at a given time. So one way to do this is to look at a functional assay for siderophores. It's called the CAS assay. It's based on chrome azural S, and you complex it with iron, add a surfactant, and put it in a buffer. And if you look at the bottom, it's blue, and that corresponds to the big blue peak in the spectrophotometer. When a siderophore removes iron from this complex, it shifts the spectrophotomic absorption down into the yellow, so roughly 375, and suddenly it's a very quantitative spectrophotomic assay to be able to measure the function of siderophores in your sample. Now, as it's published, there's a couple of issues in terms of looking at either microcosm scale in the laboratory and particularly in the field. This assay has a lower limit of about 2 micromolar, and surfactants tend to be pretty toxic, especially to fungi. So one of the things I wanted to do when I was at North Carolina, or I still am at North Carolina, is look at ways to modify this assay to make it functional to actually be able to try and address some of the questions we have about the biological role in mineral weathering. So the first thing I wanted to do was, if you have an organism you can culture, and particularly if it's a fungi, you want a quick and easy way to be able to screen, do they make siderophores, do they make a lot of siderophores? But because the surfactant tends to be very toxic, just trying to grow them on a plate with a CAS assay in it doesn't work. Usually they either don't grow or they don't grow very well. So one of the ways we got around this was by making a layer plate, putting the CAS nutrient agar on the bottom layer and putting a layer of nutrient agar across the top. This forms a gradient. The assay will diffuse through it, but the surface of the plate is low enough toxicity that the fungi tend to grow pretty much normally. And you actually, as long as you're pipetting these, you can make this quantitative. And you can look at a time series. This is just two examples, two different fungi of manganese oxidizing fungi grown on these plates. And I took photos at day 2, 5, 8, and 11. And you can actually, at the same time, measure how much the fungi has grown and how much siderophore they have produced. And this doesn't tell you what siderophores they're producing, but it tells you how much and how quickly. So this is a quick and easy way to screen for potentially the most important organisms in your system. And then the other side of it, we've also modified the CAS assay to work in a range of 10 to 50 nanomolar. So this allows us to actually take 100 microliter samples directly from the environment and measure them with very little processing. Basically, you have to filter out any particulates and you can measure it right away. It takes a couple of hours. So this is a quick and easy, relatively easy, quick and cheap way to measure siderophores in environmental samples, and we have verified this on stream waters to date, and the next step would be to actually make this work on soil water. But it is a very small sample size, and you can measure directly in the right range for what we think environmental concentrations of siderophores are. Another potential step, using the iron, we can only really measure very high affinity siderophores, but you can use different metals in this particular assay, for example, copper, and that actually reduces the strength of the assay, and you can measure lower affinity molecules, including some of the dicarboxylic acids. So this method can potentially be modified to actually be able to measure a wider range of chelation activity in soils. And that's one of the goals, is to be able to take some of these methods and go back to the field and see what is it at this molecular process level beneath the two different sides of my field site that is actually contributing to the mineral weathering that we see. And this is something in general I think is the approach that I'm taking to try and understand processes at the bigger, more complicated level, is to break it down step by step, but then always try and apply it back into the field. And with that, many thanks to the very many people that have helped and funding sources that have been part of all of this different work. So thank you.
All right, I think we can pick maybe one question before we go on to the next speaker.
Very, very interesting what you showed. I was wondering, how did you keep the extramycorrhizae and any other Mr. Foster and the abostomycorrhizae separate? How did you separate
them? We inoculated. So I should have mentioned. So we they weren't sterilized. We washed the roots, and they came from a nursery, so they were not pre-inoculated, and we checked the roots. So they were mostly had no mycorrhiza when we started the experiment, and we inoculated them. We went to an arboretum, found the same species of trees, took soil and fungus from beneath those trees, and inoculated our experiments. So we had, we added dominantly arbuscular mycorrhiza to the mycorrhiza and dominantly ectomycorrhizal to those. But when we did check the staining experiments, that was exclusively what we saw in the two. So there may have been other fungus there, but it wasn't the dominant fungi.
So are they exclusive ectomycorrhizal?
For the most part. There are a few tree species that can bond with both, but for the most part, they seem to be fairly exclusive.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.